Denk an den 31. Juli.
Wieso?
Last Call für deine Steuer.
Oh no, ich weiß gar nicht, wo ich anfangen soll.
Weil wieso Steuer? Das ist wie Steuererklärung, nur ohne Stress.
Ist das einfach?
Klar, macht fast alles automatisch.
Dauert das lange?
Nö, einfach per App.
Na dann.
Hol dir jetzt dein Geld zurück mit Wieso Steuer. Bis zum 31. Juli abgeben.
Welcome to Mysterious Universe, Season 34, Episode 16. Coming up on the show, we've got Guarding the Inner Borders, Night Duty on the Spirit Road, and Getting Drained by the Xian Nu. I'm your host, Benjamin Grundy. Joining me is Aaron Wright.
What does that last part specifically refer to?
You've never been drained by the Xian Nu?
No, I haven't. No, but from some of the imagery you're creating today, I'm a little bit terrified.
Yeah, the AI moderator wouldn't let me generate a lot of images for the show today.
Rightly so, from what I've seen.
Xian Nu is like a fairy maiden, a Chinese fairy maiden, but it also applies to the idea of heavenly being, some kind of ascended heavenly master. But it's often applied to, you know, those images you see, the traditional images of the fairy maidens. They're all in flowing dresses.
Yeah, like you mean from like European folklore?
No, this is specifically Chinese. Like floating down from the clouds. I've got an example I'll put up on the screen.
Oh, yeah, I know the style. Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah.
That's a Xian Nu. Well, I was
very diaphanous.
It's interesting how the encounters from Chinese folklore and even from fairly modern reports of encounters with these beings overlaps with alien abductions and fairy folklore from the West. And this all came together in a book that just came out on October the 15th. It's, let me put it on the screen here, Stars That Pause, 2000 Years of Asian UFO Encounters and Lore.
Oh, interesting. I missed this.
It's by Yi Izzy Yu and John Yu Branscombe. And they've actually been writing and translating some work we've been following in the past. We covered this one back in, I think, July of 2021, The Shadow Book by Ji Yun, which is really fascinating because this guy was like a prodigy. He was, I think, the seventh smartest guy in, you know, the national exams they have.
Yes.
He was the seventh best.
Wow.
He ended up being the special advisor to the emperor in the 18th century. He was the minister of war, the minister of scrolls and all this other stuff. Like a really incredible statesman and scholar. But towards the end of his life, he started to release a series of books in a particular genre that at the time was kind of like spooky ghost stories.
Yes, right.
The genre, they wrote another book about it called Zhe Guai.
Chinese True Tales of the Paranormal and Glitches in the Matrix. There's Chinese Glitches in the Matrix?
Well, that's the term of the genre. It's not specifically Glitches in the Matrix, but it's something of an umbrella term for paranormal stories, strange encounters. It's stuff that couldn't be put into the official records.
Yes.
And because towards the end of his career, this guy, what was his name again? Ji Yun. He was made in charge of the Imperial Library. It was his job to look after it.
So what, he scurried away just like these reports and hid them in a secret dossier somewhere?
Well, it's like he became annoyed because Confucianism dominated at this time period and it was very materialistic.
Very much so, yes.
And there wasn't much room for anything outside of the box. And he was annoyed by this because he was kind of like this on the download John Keel type character where over the years he'd been collecting these reports, collecting eyewitness accounts, collecting stories. And to the surprise and consternation of his peers at the time and all these materialist Confucianists, he released the Shadow Book.
Mm.
And the Shadow Book was five volumes full of what you would call today ghost stories.
Sure.
But it also had stories of high strangeness, like encounters with spirits, including one of them, which is a straight up UFO abduction.
Great.
Like a straight up alien abduction. And while Yi Izzy Yu and John Branscombe were translating this book, they came across this alien abduction account. And the amazing thing about it is it's actually written directly by Ji Yun. It's a friend of his who experiences it.
Oh.
And because they translated that, they thought, this is weird. They started looking into it. And so they found all these incredible stories of what we would look at today as classic UFO encounters, classic abduction tales, like classic UFO high strangeness that occurred through centuries in China. And they've all put it in this new book called The Stars That Pause.
Well, it's hardly surprising, though, that there would be, you know, those sorts of encounters, because one thing that we've always said is that this phenomenon is a human phenomenon. Like, it's the phenomenon interacts with humanity. So it doesn't matter what part of the world you're in, but you're totally right. It's like a lot of this stuff, it's like what happened with Russia or with the Soviets. It's like all that kind of stuff, even though it was, you know, it was occurring and, you know, up the upper echelons of the government were certainly looking into it. It was all hush hush. And it's like, let's not talk about it. Let's keep it to the side. But this stuff happens all around the world.
It does. And countless reports that we've never heard because they're bound up in languages we don't speak and cultures that are, you know, inaccessible. But, you know, props to these guys. I do like their work, and they've gone and made a huge effort at translating some of these old reports. I'm looking forward to going into that. And ultimately, it does lead back to the White Lady.
Oh, no.
Well, the crossovers between the Xian Nu, these fairy goddesses, White Lady are incredible.
Okay.
So, right, yeah, that's coming up. What have you got coming up?
Well, later on the Plus extension, actually, I was reading this great write-up about a woman who had a very strange encounter in, of all places, a graveyard. Now, graveyards traditionally already have that, you know, haunted, spooky kind of Halloween feel to them. But the reality is that, you know, there are a number of very level-headed researchers of, you know, paranormal and high strangeness that go into these locations trying to seek out some of the most unusual encounters. And that's exactly what happened to this woman. She wasn't entirely expecting to have the encounter that she did, but it's the kind of thing that fits in with this genre of, you know, things where it changes your perception upon the phenomenon very rapidly. So I'm going to go into that story and then follow along with some of these kind of histories and narratives that follow this theme of the entities that stalk graveyards. And we're not just talking about ghosts. We're talking about strange cryptid creatures. We're talking about strange animals that can morph and change shape and then disappear into a cloud of smoke, that kind of stuff. Mm. So we'll get into that later on in the show.
Yeah, looking forward to that. Well, let's jump into it. Stars That Pause, it's available now. And yeah, they were inspired by this Shadow Book of Ji Yun. That's what they were translating. Let me put him up on the screen here. I'm just fascinated by this guy because he's like, he's the ultimate statesman. Like, he was the Minister of War.
Yes. And the Imperial Head Librarian.
Yeah, the Head Librarian and the Assistant to the Emperor. He was the leader of, I guess you would call, the conventional structure of power. And he, at the end, he's like, screw it.
Yeah, but
I'm just gonna write this incredible book of weirdness and just blow everyone's mind.
Good. I mean, yet again, though, this is a recurring theme that happens with anyone who is involved in this type of phenomena, is that it's like it happens again around the world in the sense that people go, oh, that's garbage, or that's not real, or I don't want to talk about it. But then you find out secretly they've had an encounter, or they've been writing about it, or they know someone who's had an encounter. It's like, because of the fear of ridicule, people go, oh, no.
And it's almost like he was annoyed at the skeptics. And I'll get into his story. I'll actually start with him. So he was born in 1724. Again, prodigy. He could read and write by the age of 4.
So exceptionally gifted.
Yeah, he placed 7th in China's national service exam, like I said. That's like he's in video games. That's like a Chinese mobile game.
Right.
Where you can get his character. He became head of the Department of Public Works, then head of the Department of War, then head of the Department of Rights, special advisor to the emperor. The whole time he was banging out these freestyle poetry things that would read at tea houses. I don't know, that was just the thing that you did back then. But when the Chinese emperor appointed him as the imperial librarian, he was overseeing this massive project, this massive library project. But his career took a darker turn, the authors write, because he was ordered to destroy and censor historical accounts that the emperor found philosophically distasteful. So anything,
so censorship, basically.
Yeah, he didn't like things that were outside of the Confucian
materialist paradigm.
Box. So when he reached old age, particularly in rebellion against the censorship and driven by his own experiences, he wrote these 5 volumes. He started to work on these, which were in that category of Zhegui, which translates to records of the strange. And he would just do it after hours in secret. But this Zhegui genre, these had long been a place where you could write about things that revealed the true nature of our world and our lives and the universe, always things were that were outside the box.
Yeah.
And they had like Taoist parables, you know, Buddhist philosophy in them. The whole idea was that they were meant to reveal some metaphysical truth, maybe using a story as a vehicle, much like what our show often does. And they said that they had the power to awaken readers to what
the
they
greater
say
reality.
Yeah, deeper principles of reality.
Yeah.
But by the time Ji-yun got to his old age, they were pure like spooky pasta.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Like all these
yourghoststories.cn.
It was really just corny Chinese ghost stories, 18th century style, and he hated it. He was like, this is crap. He said, he adhered to the traditional historian's approach. He wanted to look at serious eyewitness accounts,
yeah,
historical records. He wanted to look at, firsthand accounts where he could find them, but also accounts he found from friends and family. His own account is in there.
What type of encounters did he
have? Well, I'll get to that. That's the first one I'll mention.
Right.
Well, it's just him relating a letter he got from his friend. And the result was these five volumes of paranormal travel memoirs, scientific reflections, parables. It's an amazing story about this guy. If you want to go into it in more depth, we covered this for our Plus members back in July of 2021. It's on season 24, episode 3, called 8 Years and 40 Seconds. So I'll link to that in the show notes if you're a Plus member. But the authors are translating his works and they come across this account. It's called Guests in the Sky. And to them, it just smacked of an alien abduction. They couldn't believe it. And let me share you the report. So this is from Ji Yun himself. He said, "One day I received a letter that was written in my language, but seemed to be written in a foreign one. It didn't make sense." He said the thoughts it expressed were odd, confused, and almost impossible to decipher. The letter's poor quality especially surprised me, since my friend Shen Tai Chan, who was highly intelligent and highly articulate, had written the letter. So yeah, this is a letter from his friend. He knows him well. And this friend is another statesman like himself, a scholar. He said the letter was disturbing too, because its tone was sorrowful. It was nostalgic. He said it was written as if it was a final goodbye. It was almost like a suicide note.
Mm.
He said, "Even though I knew that Tai Chan had just begun a probationary post in Shanxi, it spelled doom for the guy." So that meant that this friend of his had just got a promotion, you know, moved to a new city. His life was on the up. Things were going well.
Perhaps he's gripped by some form of melancholy or something in his new position.
Well, it's like his fears are confirmed, because he said, "Not long after that, I received word that there were no more letters that would be coming. Tai Chan, my friend, was dead." He said, "Life is filled with strange happenings, but this was not something I could let go." He said, "I couldn't let it pass. I had to figure out what the hell happened to him." He said, "I talked to Tai Chan's neighbors and his friends, his family members and his enemies." So he, you know, went to the city he was from and tracked down all these people.
How did he die? Or no one knew? Like, did he disappear, or he did pass away?
Well, he said he just passed away. Illness is suspected, but right. He said, "I pieced together what had pushed my friend to his tragic end. I think it was suicide, actually. He did end his own life." He said, "This is what I discovered." So that summer, Tai Chan, his friend, had gone to the Xi'an Mountains, you know, this traditionally very spiritual, beautiful area in China, full of forests and, you know, spectacular views. And he had just gotten over a long illness and, you know, he's starting to feel better. So he went out there on a hunting trip to try and
convalesce,
just get, you know, get his old mojo back. So he's out in the forest doing his hunting and walking. And the trip went well. He had a successful hunt and, you know, felt really good and nothing extraordinary about it until he was leaving the woods. And when he left the woods, they write that, well, something followed him out. Apparently, he said, two orbs in the sky were pursuing him. They were turning like windmills. And I've gone into the old AI generator and done some little videos of what it might look like. This is how he kind of described it in his book.
It's like spinning wheels in the sky.
But interestingly, he said no one else could see the orbs. Even Tai Chan didn't see them in that way, the way one normally sees them. He said he could look up in the sky and he would be able to see these things even with his eyes closed. So it suggests that, you know, he's not looking with his flesh eyes. He's maybe looking with his third eye or something. Yeah. For several days, he said these orbs silently followed, then suddenly, without warning, they broke open. And from inside, two young women emerged, floated down, and delivered a message that their mistress, a Xianyu immortal, wished to meet Tai Chan. Isn't that bizarre?
It is bizarre.
So they float down and see him. So again, what is Xianyu? And that's that fairy character that I showed you earlier, a maiden. So not knowing that he could not, well, knowing, sorry, that he could not reject an invitation, this is not something or someone that you say no to, he agrees to meet this heavenly fairy maiden, this goddess. Instantaneously, he's transported to a room and he says it's unlike any he's ever been in. The dimensions were dizzying. Its massive jade walls were eccentrically decorated with these strange purple shells.
Like, oh, that's weird.
What is that? The room's strangeness made Tai Chan tremble, but its effect paled compared to the appearance of the Xianyu mistress. She was beautiful, but he said it wasn't the kind of beauty that you would feel at ease with. It was something disturbing. It was like a sharp, deadly kind of beauty, something that exceeds limits.
Well, I mean, you know, pit vipers, when they're glistening in the sun, can look quite spectacular, but there's a beauty to them, but you know that it's dangerous.
That's a great analogy. That's exactly what it sounds like. It sounded dangerous, a dangerous kind of beauty. So he goes and encounters this goddess, and she immediately asks him to become her lover.
Well, this has got Boas all over it, doesn't it?
Well, he's like, can you buy me a drink first? I don't know if this seems a bit sudden. And
she doesn't have a pyramid like in a pocket or something, does she? Well, ready to go.
He literally says to her, I'm overwhelmed. I can't agree to this. The fairy maiden becomes absolutely enraged. The next thing he knows, he's waking up on the road where the women first approached him. He's all dazed. He feels like that he's been missing time. You know, his pants are on backwards. He has no idea what's happened. So he hoped that was the end of the matter and just went on with his life thinking, okay, that was weird. But several weeks later, the two rotating spheres reappeared, and so did the two female servants. This time they didn't ask him to come with them. They just took him. They abducted him. But this time he was taken to a new location. The room he found himself in wasn't as ostentatious. It wasn't as shocking. It was a little bit dumbed down. It was smaller, homelier, less exotic. The colors and furnishing was pretty normal. And it's supposedly much easier on his mind. So once again, he encounters her, and this time she was prepared for him.
Right.
This is the video I got banned from.
That's the
from.
One you got banned from. Yes, that makes sense.
The earlier...
Did you like reach the limits of inflation, did you?
Yes, the earlier generations had much bigger features.
Right.
The AI was like, no, sir. We're not doing this, sir. I don't care how much money you pay a month. So now that he feels more at ease, he has no choice and he just says yes. He says, all right, I'll be your lover. She declares he no longer has any reason to reject her. He agrees. So from then on, they meet regularly during both waking and dreaming states. Tell no one, she says to him. Tai Chan promised not to tell anyone, and he didn't for a long time, not even when he got sick.
It sounds like he was actually ravished. Like ravished to extinction.
Something like that. But finally, the severity of the illness he had taken up convinced him to visit a doctor. Now, this doctor was someone who specialized not only in physical ailments, but also spiritual issues. And the doctor immediately prescribes him like pills for his jing, for his energy, because he's so depleted. The doctor's never seen anything like it.
Yeah, it's draining his energy. It's consuming him.
But it was too late. He couldn't keep down the pills or the herbs that were prescribed. He couldn't keep down anything else. And so this is, to answer your question earlier, this is how he passed away. Everything he ate was vomited back up. He died during one of these vomiting fits, and his last letter was written during these weeks of illness. So this was the last letter sent to Ji-yun. So the question is, well, why him? Because he's just in the forest, minding his own business. He's on a hunting trip. He's just trying to live his life. Why him? Well, Ji-yun says, "I will not forget Shen Taichan, my friend. He wrote poetry that moved the heart and opened the mind. His calligraphy dazzled. He was witty, fun, generous. However, no one is without secrets or vices. And I discovered one more fact about Taichan during my investigation." He said it was one that might provide a clue to how all these weird events began. He said in Taichan's middle age, he had begun to mourn the passing of his youthful looks and he started to obsess about death. This launched his pursuit of a formula of immortality. He acquired books of occult knowledge and sought out alchemists and sorcerers who were rumored to dabble in forbidden magic. It's no surprise, Ji-yun says, that something then inexplicable occurred that ultimately led to his death.
Mm.
And this is where Ji-yun reveals his wisdom. And perhaps it's a wisdom gained from just, well, living in a more enlightened time in regards to spiritual matters.
Or being observant.
Or maybe he became observant because he had been studying these topics Correct. For decades. He had a keen understanding of it. And this is what he said. While spiritual entities of many kinds exist, they usually won't molest human beings unless a person goes out of their way to make themselves known to them.
It's the vampire folklore. It's that you have to invite it in. And that's what he did, because also it was pressuring him saying, "I want you to be my lover." And even though it got enraged because he initially said no.
How many times
you can't force people?
Have we seen this over the years doing this show?
This
person suddenly been invaded by weird poltergeist demonic activity. They're seeing ghosts and shadow beings in their home.
But also their lives are falling apart.
I wonder what caused this. Oh, they've been on the Ouija board for years. Oh, they've been involved in a dark occult cult.
Out in the woods.
In the woods, summoning demons. Oh, what a surprise. He says, "Through my investigations, it seems to me that the manifestations of such entities and the tragedies that follow in their wake are prompted not by events in the external world, but mysteriously conjured by events in one's internal world, the desires of the heart and what one dares imagine. If only Taichan had guarded these inner borders better." And I just love that, because I really thought that summed up the warnings that we inevitably end up giving when we cover these topics now, because we've seen the pattern so distinctly emerge from this research over the years, that you have to guard those inner borders, that it is ultimately up to the individual to guard and cultivate those inner borders, keep them up.
Well, there's also a greater similarity here in the cultures as well, because he was living amongst, you know, a culture that, while, you know, enlightened, was, well, not completely enlightened, but, you know, was what appeared to be a functional good culture. It was like leaning heavily towards materialism. And when you lean heavily towards materialism, this kind of stuff doesn't exist. And if it doesn't exist, then you're not prepared to defend against it.
I mean,
so you're disarmed.
That's true. But also relative to today, we would be way more material than 18th century China.
I feel like, because people go, "Oh, you know, the world is now being infested with demons and, you know, the way," but people are behaving very peculiarly. I mean, I know that humanity has got its own issues, but people are, you know, it's like you hear it so repeatedly, "Oh, I don't know what possessed me." Usually when they get caught or are being exposed on social media or, you know, or before a judge, usually that's what they say. But some of the deranged stuff that you see, that the way that people behave with, you know, no shame or no concern, a person could go, "Yeah, we are infested with demons." But I think what's going on here is simply that we have now become globally a culture which is not aware of the dangers of the spiritual world. And as a result, we are totally disarmed against it.
Yeah, that's a great point. I agree. Disarmed is a good word there. Like, those inner borders have just crumbled.
Gone. And so you let anything attach to you, you let anything control you. It's not as extreme as demonic possession, but it is spirit attachment. They influence you, and that influence is that they don't care what happens to you.
Now, do you agree with the authors that this has a lot of overlap with modern abduction?
Yeah, it does, especially from the sexual element of that. But I feel like it has more of an overlap with European folklore.
It does.
Like these entities. But I mean, as something that I was reading today, and we might go into that in the Plus extension, is this idea that, well, these are just simply entities that masquerade as you know, as aliens, and then they change to ghosts, and then they change to a cryptid. It's like they simply match whatever was going on with the society at the time.
Well, I agree with you. I don't think it's a slam dunk of, well, this is the same abduction phenomenon that we report on the show.
It's got elements of it, like ending up in that room and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, there's the elements like being taken against his will, the orbs, obviously, that's a key feature.
But orbs are also key features of spirit encounters.
Exactly. So I think it has more in common with the spirit encounters of the Western occult literature versus alien abduction, because there's already a massive overlap there.
Well, you know what is the red herring, and that is that he was dabbling in the occult, essentially.
Exactly. Exactly. So they do mention the overlap, saying that it's trickster-like entities, you know, traversing realms. It's manipulating time. It's deploying paranormal powers, abducting humans. And in terms of the fae from the West, the fairies in the Western lore, like before they were transformed in the Victorian era to the little cute Disney guys, they were powerful, you know, dangerous human-sized entities of another world. And those who claimed experience with them describe profound psychological effects identical to alien abductees. Altered personalities, missing time, unexplained illnesses, acquisition of secret knowledge. They also face similar social responses. So, you know, mockery and
well, destruction of their lives.
Everything that goes with it.
Mm.
But it's interesting because in the book they have, it's like rabbit holes. They have a section literally called rabbit holes at the end. And one of the rabbit holes they go into is comparing this account from Ji-Yun's friend with Chris Bledsoe's UFO of God memoir from 2023. Right. And of course his encounters with orbs and the white lady, which is the same archetype. It's
very much so.
It's this heavenly goddess that he encounters. Both carry unusual credibility. They write Ji-Yun, a government official, leading scholar, intimately investigated his friend Tai Chan's case. And Bledsoe's memoir, on the other hand, has the CIA guys, the NASA guys involved, Colonel John B. Alexander, Jim Semivance, another CIA guy. So despite being written hundreds of years apart, they point out that the narratives of these two accounts, they kind of line up perfectly. During Bledsoe's Cape Fear River encounter, remember when the orbs came and froze him and his son?
Yes.
They had missing time. You know, these strange luminous orbs pieced together memories. He recalled meeting beings of light in a craft, a feminine entity he calls the lady, who thereafter regularly visits him, just like Tai Chan's experiences in 18th century China.
Remind me, was that physically or like in a dream state?
He saw her physically and in a dream state.
So again, very similar.
Exactly the same as Tai Chan. Like Tai Chan's ongoing relationship with the Xianyu immortal, Bledsoe's contact continues for an extended time through both involuntary abductions and voluntary communion during both dreams and waking states, as we said. Both men's encounters follow intense illnesses. And I forgot this about Bledsoe's account. He writes in his book about Crohn's disease and stomach issues that were just absolutely plaguing him to the point where he couldn't work anymore, his business was falling apart, and he was just desperate for some relief. And in fact, in a Coast to Coast interview, they point out that he recalled, "I was at the bottom of my barrel crying out to God, help me. What do I do? How do I feed my kids?" He was desperate. And so they then cite a religious historian named Mircea Eliade, who calls this a shamanic illness, an intense crisis, severe illness, a bout of madness. It's a kind of ego death.
Yes.
Breakdown of the personal situation. Suffering is the admission price, she says, to enter the theater of the gods. It triggers altered states of consciousness, thus fulfilling the same psychological function as more intentional practices. So it's like, yeah, you can spend
decades
meditating in a cave, or you can have your entire life destroyed. Either one is like a wake-up call, right? When the mind is cracked open, they write, shamanic encounters with spirit guides can begin. So this researcher, Eliade, says that the content of these first ecstatic experiences almost always includes ascent to the sky and dialogue with the gods and spirits, or descent to the underworld and conversations with spirits and souls of dead shamans. So Tai Chan's experience in China in the 18th century has exactly that, that soul flight to another dimension. The rotating orbs open to reveal female beings. He levitates to this strange chamber. Bledsoe's is the same. He has a soul flight. He ascends to, this time it's a craft, not a chamber, but very much the same thing. He meets a female entity. She's, again, the white lady is overwhelmingly beautiful, overwhelmingly powerful. Most remarkably, they write, the description of the orbs they both encounter are reminiscent not just of each other, but other modern accounts. And they talk about sightings of these orbs in the Wudang Mountains in China. And of course, we've covered the orb sightings a lot over the years. So,
well, also it was on the border with India, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, a lot of sightings up there. But Bledsoe, he calls them angelic energy beings, these orbs. He says they can morph into whatever you need to see.
Yes.
He said he's morphed into faces and beings with wings and angels. So they talk about this being all transformative, and it points to the fact that these UFO encounters in some senses are purely spiritual experiences, right? It's not the way a lot of people think about it, where
it's a physical
event. Nuts and bolts physical event. And I'm not saying that's all of these encounters, but there is a large category of them that lean more to this side of it being some spontaneous shamanistic experience. They reference the Free study, the FREE study. Remember that, where they looked at experiences and abductees. It was over 4,000 contactees.
Oh, yes.
From over 100 countries. We covered it on a previous episode. So the experiences in that report, they claimed they had increased spiritual awareness.
That's right.
Heightened telepathy. Ecological concerns, and they got healing abilities. And Kenneth Ring, he did this in the Omega Project. He studied abductees and found a similar shift, reduced materialism, environmental consciousness, psychic sensitivity, a deeper spiritual orientation. All these things were consistent. And so this follows what Chris Bledsoe experienced as well. He showed heightened spiritual abilities. Remember, he was claiming he was healing people. He healed his sick dog, healed some guy who had a heart attack at that party.
That's
right. Described. And now he's dedicated to teaching his experiences, sharing his experiences. But it's funny because they draw all these parallels. Then they get to Tai Chan. And yeah, he underwent a dramatic change. He started seeing this goddess-like being on the regular. And then he wound up dead.
Mm.
He was killed because of this encounter.
He wasn't killed. He was consumed.
He was consumed, yeah. He no longer had any energy to sustain himself. His encounter proves deadly. But it's funny, they say in the book, they're like, well, negative transformation is still transformation. So he was still transformed.
but he wasn't transformed in a spiritual sense that a form of him would go on. He was consumed. Like, he was annihilated.
But that's still transformation, right? He went from being alive to dead. Fully transformed.
So what, are they suggesting that it's still good?
Yeah, well, they say his death represents what shamanic traditions call the dangers of unprepared contact with otherworldly forces. And I do agree with that. Because remember, he was the one that was seeking out occult secrets to his attachment to his youthful looks and just youth in general. Ultimately, both accounts, they say, follow the shamanic template. Crisis-altered consciousness, otherworldly contact, and profound transformation. But it's this profound transformation that I'm a real stickler for. Because
it was profound, all right.
What is the nature of the transformation? What are you transforming into?
Food.
Well, I mean, if you look at the transformations made from these abductees who respond to these this free study and all the cases we've covered over the years, you know, it is this pattern that you see where all of a sudden they're more environmentally conscious. Like, we've got to worry about the Earth.
And nuclear weapons. More, it's the classic contactee stuff.
We've got to worry about Gaia more than we have to worry about human beings. Gaia comes first for some weird reason.
Do you know what I heard recently? And look, I didn't know people were like, oh, I can't believe it, but I'll link to it, right? So it was Alex Jones. I know that Alex Jones is an extremely controversial figure and he says a lot of things that are really out there. However, I was just intrigued to see what his opinions are. I like to have a wide spectrum of things. He was talking to Tucker Carlson, and he was talking about a collection of people that are in Silicon Valley, right, and the upper echelons and these all these elites, right?
Yeah.
They're all in DMT and ayahuasca, which is DMT, but all these, you know,
microdosing mushrooms.
Yeah, all these hallucinogenic substances, right? And he was saying, so I do take it with a grain of salt, but he was saying that all of them are being told that you have to reduce the human population to save the environment.
By the entities,
yeah, by the entities that they are experiencing when they are taking these substances,
right,
all of them, so and disconnected from each other, right? So people that, you know, they might have business contacts, but are taking these substances separately and are meeting the same entities, and the entities are telling them the same story. Uh-huh. And isn't it strange that these people that do have the ability to influence what goes on in our world, you know, immense power, you know, power that they probably shouldn't have actually. But they have immense power. These beings are saying the only way to save Earth is to wipe out humanity.
Sure. Well, again, Jones often speaks in extremes, but if there is some truth to that, isn't that an incredible insight? Well, because this is my argument, is that the transformation that's being made to these people is they're not necessarily transforming into a higher being. They're not raising their vibrations. What they're becoming is more like these beings that they claim to be in contact with, which is explicitly not human.
No, it's explicitly anti-human.
Exactly. And so their motives and their desires seem to go against the, I guess, the benefits of human beings.
Well, this is why I mentioned it, because you can go, you know, I don't care what your political standings are, but people immediately will reel from that. But it's like, hang on a second. What he's describing, regardless of, you know, where he stands, is the exact same things we've been hearing for years upon years of people that are interacting with non-human intelligences, whether it's contactees, whether it's abductees, whether it's people that get caught up in these wild goose chases. Like, I keep on being reminded of the guy that had like a portal open at the end of a runway that he owned and seeing mammoths. The guy was annihilated.
Yeah, their lives become destroyed. They lose all touch with the reality that allows you to function in human society. And they start to believe things they're told. Like, for example, this is one of the classic ones, that alien beings created human beings.
Yep.
Not gods anymore.
No.
Not even evolution.
No.
But aliens created human beings. So now they are de facto our masters.
Correct.
They have become our gods.
Yep. Well, we become their slaves.
Right. This is something that exists in this pattern of people that are go through this shamanic transformation from abductions.
I've noticed this. And this is something that, you know, because I feel like modern religion in all sense has been corrupted. Like it's been infiltrated. It's been corrupted. And people, I think, you know, I do agree that, you know, your spiritual experience is within you. Like, and it's for you to go through it and to, you know, work out what's real and what's the truth and that kind of thing. But what I do like about Christianity, right, just as one example, is that we are all the children of a higher, greater, benevolent entity, right? Like we are the children.
A loving God, sure.
Yeah, it's a loving, benevolent God. Like, and it's higher than us. And even if we make mistakes and even if we do things, as long as you try to be a better person and you ask for forgiveness for the mistakes that you've made and the bad things that you've done, there's a chance for you, right? Whereas with that narrative that these contactees and abductees are being told about aliens, there's nothing benevolent about it. It's like a expectation of worship. It's actually creating slaves.
Mm.
Like you are a slave to this belief of these higher beings, but these higher beings are like, you owe me something.
Well, if they become your creators, they are now your masters.
Correct.
By default.
Correct, but it's not benevolent. It's not this forgiveness. It's not this like, well, you know, it's like, no. As you are now part of us, you must follow what we tell you to do.
And you'll also notice the people that have these experiences and these abductions, they're never becoming more orthodox when they come back.
Correct.
They're always saying, well, religion's an illusion. And
that's what I mean.
The patriarchy's controlled, they've controlled us through the chains of religion for so many centuries. Like it's always this kind of narrative.
Well, in some sense they may have, because that's why I'm saying I believe today that it's all completely corrupted, but it's probably them.
Well,
it's probably these low-level entities.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, it's like they attack the foundations that can really save human beings.
Correct.
What I really think is the standout thing that links them all together is these experiences, they just start becoming more like the beings that they're in touch with. They start becoming less human, more anti-human, and they're all about transformation, post-humanism, just becoming something extra. It's always like the evolution of humankind. It's the transcendence, how we're going to leave from our 3D bodies and merge with the high. Like, it's all about being non-human. And so I'm always very skeptical about this. And especially
about giving up your humanity, Ben.
Especially when one of the guys in your example, he's literally dead.
Yeah.
They killed him.
Yeah. And it's not like, again, it's not even like what you hear in, because I think that there's a lot of good in shamanism as well. I know that, you know, we've spoken about some of the dangers of it, and it's even mentioned there, right, of an uninitiated person. But shamanism like has some goodness to it, has a lot of goodness to it in certain circumstances. But it's like when you hear about these stories of ego death, for example, and someone's ego and like those negative attributes of themselves are annihilated, but then they, you know, come out of it as a, you know, a spiritually aware, more compassionate person. That didn't happen to him. He was just consumed. It's not like he's had an ego death. He's had a death.
Literally blown to death.
It's not like his spirit has risen or anything like that. It's like he's been destroyed.
Yeah. So that's what started it all. They read that account and they thought, that's incredible how it crosses over with so many of these modern accounts, including Bledsoe's. And so they spent a lot of time going into more of these classic reports that just, I want to read you some of them because they're really bizarre for the time period. For example, there's one from, I think this was like the 15th century, at Luo River, two spiral shell-like objects as big as hills would periodically emerge from the water, light blazing from their tops so bright that the sky would light up even during the day. These curiosities were capable of incredible speed and could cover 31 miles in a flash. Whenever these objects appeared, the weather would turn stormy.
Interesting.
15th century.
But that has a more UFO kind of feel to it.
Mm. The next one's from the Dream Pool essays from the year 1088. Between the years of 1056 and 1063, a flying object, round and shiny like a pearl, came to Yangzhou City and was seen by many. It flew at night and retreated to local waters during the day. My friend's summer house, the reporter wrote, bordered on Pishe Lake. One evening, the object rose from the water and drifted towards him. When close, its outer shell opened and horizontal rays of light shot out, pulsing from gold to silver, so dazzling that my friend could only look at it from the corner of his eyes. Sound familiar? A chamber lay inside the opened shell. It held a floating orb the size of a fist, which this was the source of the light, which now fully exposed became even more intense that it illuminated miles of forest and made the sky glow as if the forest was on fire. All of a sudden, the object sealed shut, shot across the lake at incredible speed.
Didn't expose him to a dose of radiation, did it?
Well, get this. They say at the end of the report, one last note is that the Yangzhou City flying object hasn't appeared for several years now. No one knows where it went. So like so many of these flaps we report on over the years, no matter what year it is, 1973 comes to mind, it's this isolated set of sightings.
Yep.
People experience things in a couple of years, then it's gone.
Then it's nothing.
That's it.
Yep.
The flap is over.
This has a very Ivan Sanderson invisible residence feel as well, because where are they emerging from? Where are they residing seemingly? Underwater.
Yeah, good point. And it's the same pattern in 11th century China.
Identical.
The next one's from a more modern era, July the 23rd, 1818. An enormous armored wheel, black in the middle, covered with lights on the outside surface, appeared in the southeastern sky during a storm. Again, storm activity.
But that is what, even just that description is what was described by Ivan Sanderson in many of these reports of, seafarers, mariners, encountering these spinning armored wheels.
It flew northwest with a whirling motion. More than 10 families witnessed the event. They reported that the wheel made a sound like thunder as it passed. And they said when it got close to homes, it would actually pull the tiles.
Right.
Like a tornado or something.
Because of the speed it's traveling at?
I don't know. It just caused great damage to the town. And then there was another report from 1573. A gigantic bird-shaped thing came from the east. It was large as a sailing ship, but with wheel-shaped wings. So that's two reports from hundreds of years apart describing
engine pod.
Wheel-shaped wings. The air grew hazy and misty when it flew and the storms erupted around it. One of my favorites diverts a little bit from objects. It's like a missing 411 report. It's from the Songzer Chronicles in 1880. So this was May the 8th of that year. Tan, a peasant who lives in Xiyanzhu, he went for a walk one morning in the woods behind his house. He encountered a small floating object that was radiating bright light, multicolored, so an orb, I guess, and he reaches out for it. The idiot actually went to touch it. As soon as he reached for it, his feet suddenly left the ground, and to his terror, he floated up so high he could hear the wind whistling past his ears. He was in a strange state at the time. Now, they talk about him having this weird semi-conscious state. He said his mind was thick and hazy, his body paralyzed. He could only feel panic as abruptly he began to fall. The next thing he knows, he's like crashing through the trees of a mountainside, but he can't recognize where he is. He's like, Where have I been transported to? What's going on?
Can he move again?
Yeah, he says once he hit the ground, he was back out of his trance. He had his full faculties about him again. He said, I felt like I'd just awakened from a dream. Now, he's extremely shocked to find himself in an unfamiliar place, and he's walking through this forest going, where the hell am I? He was lucky because a woodcutter passed, and this woodcutter sees that the guy's freaked out and says, oh, are you okay? Where are you from? And he says, I'm from Songzhe, Hubei province. And the guy looks at him. He's like, what are you talking about? That's like 1,000 li from here.
So he was transported somehow.
He tells him, this is Guizhou province. What are you even doing here? You're so far away from home. I looked it up today on the map. So
that is a considerable distance.
Songzhe is the top right there. It's an 8-hour and 41-minute drive.
Yep. 9 hours.
So he's just been teleported across the country. So the woodcutter guides him down the mountain, and he spends nearly 20 days walking home. He has to beg for food and drink on the way home. And there's no explanation for it. That's the story. Now, I wonder what actually happened to the guy.
There was no regression hypnosis back then,
exactly.
Was there?
Exactly. Did he have memories emerge of being probed by the goddess or other hideous creatures, other Xian Nu?
Well, was he also harassed afterwards?
Yeah, we don't know. So they do add commentary on this later. Like they talk about the Berkshire County, Massachusetts encounter from 1969.
What was that one?
It's where a bunch of people saw luminous objects.
Were people teleported or somehow?
Yeah, it was run in the newspapers in the Berkshire Eagle. It was on radio broadcasts, and it triggered a flood of emergency calls to the Berkshire police as over 250 residents independently reported UFO encounters and abduction experiences. So one of them was the Reed family. I'm sure we've covered the case on the show before.
Yeah, it's vaguely familiar.
They came across two luminous orbs, again, like Tai Chan's case, that sporadically emitted beams of light. There was a classic disc-shaped craft that accompanied them. They then lost 3 hours they can't account for. When they regained awareness, several family members retained fragmented memories of medical examinations in an enormous chamber resembling a ship's hull. The funniest part, or most disturbing part, depending on how you look at it, is the mother was driving and the grandmother was in the passenger seat. And the grandmother couldn't drive a car. She had never got her license. But when they returned back to the car and the car was driving on the highway, but they mixed it up. So the grandma was driving and the mother was in the passenger seat. And the grandma can't drive. So she's like, oh, what's going on? She just had to stop. Two other Berkshire residents independently provided testimony without prior communication for the Reed family because they described beams and levitating and abduction experiences.
Isn't it strange, though, how it's like, all this time has passed, but they haven't really changed their shtick, have they?
Not really.
Like they will, you know, obviously adjust it occasionally, but it seems to be a recurring theme.
Yeah. Seems like it hasn't changed for 1,000 years. And they also mentioned Carrie Mullis dancing naked in the minefield. Remember the scientist who, was he the guy that discovered the telomerase?
Oh, the PCR, the polymerase chain reaction. Yeah.
PCR, thank you. And he discovered that through dreams and connections with UFOs and aliens.
Right.
But you'll remember he had screen memories of glowing raccoons.
That's right, yes.
And he also, him and his daughter had missing time, and they were also teleported to other regions in California, like other places on the mountain, without an explanation for it. So there's just a lot of this you see in UFO encounters today. And we know this, you know, ending up in some weird location with no way to account for it, no way to travel that distance. There's another, again, relatively more modern one. And there's a newspaper image from when this was published in 1892. This was September the 18th of that year.
Why is there a crowd standing upon a bridge?
Well, this is Nanjing City, and there was a gigantic bright red egg floating in the sky for like hours.
Mm.
Hundreds and hundreds of people saw it. And
is that this thing in the distance, is it?
Yeah. So if you zoom in on the image, so everyone's pointing, they're all pointing and looking at something in the sky, and that's it there. You can see it floating. And so hundreds of people saw this, clearly visible in the dusk sky. It drifted slowly from west to east through the clouds, and it was there for like all of dinner time, and then it just vanished. And it's funny because it's the same, it plays out the same way that you would have a modern UFO sighting like this with so many eyewitnesses, because the skeptics all come out, and the skeptics are like, oh, well, there was a child's party and they had a lantern, and so clearly everyone's just watching a lantern. But then people are like, no, there was a wind, a strong wind, and it was going against the wind, and it was up for so long in the same spot. There's no way it was a lantern. You know, other people said it was a meteor, but meteors are fast and this thing was slow. One man, elderly man, said to the paper, the object made a faint sound when it first appeared, but also seemed to jump an incredible distance into the sky above us.
Oh, so that rapid movement.
Yeah, quite odd, he said. And then they move on to more modern reports. So they've got the one from the Korean War in 1951. You might remember this one. It was from...
You mean when a soldier was chopping through the forest and came upon a crashed UFO or a UFO with greys loading body parts onto it?
No, not that extreme.
Not that extreme.
No,
okay.
This is Private First Class Francis P. Wall. He was in a village near Chorwon, and he and his regiment, they saw this luminescent orb, and it just starts flying through, and it descended towards a village where that was under active artillery fire, and it started zipping through air bursts and, you know, going through flak.
Yeah, it was impervious,
zipping around, nothing could affect it. And Wall, he fired armor piercing bullets from his M1 rifle, and it's interesting because he said in his report that he hit it. And they all heard this ping, 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 yeah. Ping, this metallic ping. And this pissed it off. Whatever this thing was, it started to beam them. So a bunch of his regiment, the bunch of the soldiers said this beam would fly out, this vertical beam would like scan them and go zzzt, zzzt to each of the soldiers.
Would it fry them or just?
Yeah, they all said that when the beam hit them, they had this burning, tingling sensation, and it felt like it was penetrating their bodies. They had to take shelter underground, and this orb followed overhead, but then disappeared. Now, they were all diagnosed with dysentery in the following days.
That's right.
Elevated white blood cell counts. They had to be evacuated for medical care. One doctor studying the case said it was like they all had been exposed to radiation.
Mm.
Wall himself suffered long-term effects, including permanent weight loss, chronic stomach problems, and memory loss. So, yeah, stay away from the orbs, people. And there's so much in this book when you look at standard UFO sightings. Like, you know, the classic Japan Airlines UFO encounter?
Yeah, didn't an orb pace a JAL-747 back in the 70s?
Yeah, maybe close. That's roughly correct. But that's not mentioned, but there's a ton like that. From domestic airlines in China.
Yeah, of course there would
be. There's at least half a dozen of them in the book. And it's just some of them are, you know, seeing multiple orbs. Some of them are seeing craft, diamond-shaped craft. There's one where there's two Chinese guys and they're the only ones at an outdoor movie, like some old outdoor cinema in the 1980s or something. And they claim a 1,000 meter long disc was floating above them and then vanished out of sight, like like an aircraft carrier.
Well, 1,000 meters is a kilometer.
That's multiple that's like aircraft carriers. Yeah. The biggest thing you'd ever imagine and floating above them.
No one else saw it. Noted it.
No, it's just these two guys.
See, that though, as much as it could be made up, right, that's certainly a possibility. And people say, you know, the most outrageous things to get attention. I'm not entirely sure with this stuff though, because I think that some people do have encounters, and much like what you were describing at the start there, where, you know, like he could see those things falling from the sky, but the companions couldn't, right? Mm. It's like you have to be on a certain wavelength. Or it attunes itself to you for some. I'm not saying you have to be enlightened or you're special or anything like that. It's just that you happen to be on that wavelength.
Yeah.
Maybe because you have been messing with the occult, or maybe you have, you know, lit yourself up to these things. It allows you to see it. And that's why other people don't see it.
Well, they had just gone to see a movie after they had finished with their occult demon summoning right. ceremony.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's exactly what happened.
And a ton of them that you might not necessarily have heard of from China that were pretty big deals. Like in 2010 in Hangzhou, they shut down the major international airport there. And it's kind of like the O'Hare incident in Chicago years ago. A commercial airliner that was flying in at about 8:40 p.m. at night, they reported seeing a light in the sky that was stationary, like a bright shining light above the airport. And a second flight that was coming in a little bit later reported it as well. Now, nothing was on radar. They couldn't detect it, but people kept on reporting it, so they didn't want to take chances. They shut down the entire airport.
Sure.
And so 18 flights were diverted. It was a huge thing. But then local residents started calling in to media and police and reporting they were seeing things as well. A local resident said at 8:26 p.m., so just 20 minutes before the airport was shut down, he was taking a nighttime walk with his wife when he felt a beam of light pass over his head. He looks up and he sees this bright white streak of light flying across the sky, but faster than any commercial plane you could ever imagine, just like shoo. He claims he saw it for 30 seconds, like it was in the sky long enough before it retreated into the distance. He managed to capture 5 photographs of it. I couldn't find them today, but dozens of other Hangzhou residents described similar accounts. Most of them described a cigar-shaped craft.
It's a very classic craft.
Yeah, red and white lights at low altitude, kind of showing up in different locations over the city. So to this day, it's like, it's a big mystery of what it was. A lot of people say, oh, advanced tech, like China's advanced military aircraft program. Like,
no, because China has just such a vast, you know, wilderness and deserts for them to be able to experiment with this kind of stuff, where it's not going to be seen by the general population.
They don't need to shut down an
Absolutely
airport.
Not.
No. So I do recommend it. I thought it was a really great collection of reports going from, you know, 11th century all the way up to modern reports. And there's great sections at the end where they go into these rabbit holes. Like I said, a lot of commentary about modern themes with the whole UFO lore. They talk about the idea of the sexual encounters that we so often see. Like, we just covered Oldfield's latest book on, what was it? What was his book called with the hybrid on the cover again? Children of the Greys?
Yeah, but it was Aftermath.
The Aftermath, Children of the Greys. So Oldfield, famous abductee, claims that he met his hybrid child. And then again, in the follow-up book we covered on Tuesday, he's seen her again when she was older. But he writes about having sex with aliens.
Is that described in this book?
Well, yeah, they go into the modern accounts from China as well. Like, we've covered a few of them, including the visit to planet Grok.
That's right.
Which is hilarious.
So that's in there?
Well, no, that's not in there, but they allude to some of those. But there's a question, like, they talk about it as a kind of, again, shamanistic transformation. And they're using, there's some kind of, it's like opening the mind. Like, when you have sex with an alien, it like breaks down the conceptions of the material world and like enlightens you. And there's all these quotes from like Cripple and all these academics and Whitley Strieber's book. And it's like, fuck off. You're not being enlightened because some alien is raping you and stealing your sperm and eggs.
Well, I think it's more than that, though. You're right. It's like stealing genetic material. But again, like it ties back into the spiritual element. It's stealing something energetic from you.
But that's why I brought up Alden, because he says, look, they weren't doing it because they were taking genetic material from
me. Yeah, it was something spiritual.
They were doing it because it's like they wanted to watch, or they were getting information from it, or they were getting something else from me. And I think, yeah, you speculated on that show. You said, well, maybe they're just taking his energy in some form that we don't understand.
I think that's highly likely.
They also suggest it's just like some weird sex tourism.
Yeah, it could be as well. All right.
We're like the seedy, Thai red-like district of the universe. They just send these like old middle-aged greys out here and they're just abducting humans.
But they just, what? I mean, who? I don't know. I'm not even going to go there.
Don't even. No. Don't.
No.
Well, what I want to leave you with, because I enjoyed this book so much, The Shadow Book of Ji Yun, I wanted to leave you with one of the stories from here that's included in his, five volumes of these bizarre stories and accounts. It's one that we haven't covered before. It's called Not That Maid. And it's about Song Ching Yuan from Dezhou. He said he told me a story about a maid once employed by the Zhu family. This maid, her name was Jia, was ugly, incredibly ugly. She had sallow skin, a bowl-shaped face, and uneven teeth that were randomly pegged into her gums. Not a looker. She moved crudely, gross, and spoke the same. Her eyes bulged with slyness and ill will. But a miracle happened shortly after Jia entered womanhood. Very quickly, like over a period of a week or two, her teeth no longer looked random but seemed artfully placed and full of charm. Her face seemed less rice bowl than moon. Her skin turned golden and her eyes were now kind and seemed to follow others with the sole intent of keeping them from harm, particularly the head of the household, Zhu. Now, it surprised no one that the head of the household, the man Zhu, confessed a romantic interest in Jia. And when she consented to be his partner, it turned out to be the best luck he'd ever had. Because not only was she now beautiful, an ugly duckling turned swan overnight, it turned out she was really sharp. She was strategic and she managed the household to perfection. Everything ran smoothly. She made all these little womanly improvements everywhere. They said she organized the affairs of the household like the beads on an abacus. Her ability gained the respect and obedience of the servants. Even the sneaks and scoundrels respected her. And to Zhu's delight, this new lover's intellect proved as nimble in business matters as household ones. She ended up getting into household goods and investitures, and she made her master a lot of money. She bought a lot of stocks that tripled in price. She bought Bitcoin back in the 18th century. I think.
Well, that would probably be the best time to buy it.
That's
sure.
What she did. And in a few years, the Jew was now much richer. He was loving this new lover of his, this new consort. And they had a harmonious bond. They had a great relationship. And even people would comment. They're like, these two were made for each other. You never see them argue. They're just like the perfect couple. At least it was that way until suddenly it was not. Because one day she came and she grabbed her master, Jia grabbed Zhu, and peered into his eyes and said to him, "Do you see me?"
Is it a fox?
Well, she said it in a strange voice he didn't recognize. And he said, "What do you mean?" And he could tell that there was something off about her, like something had changed. And he starts saying, "Jia, my sweet pet, Jia, my little bunny." Like he gives her these pet names.
Yeah.
He says to try and bring her back from under a clear spell she's under. She replies and says, "I'm neither one of those people. That maid of yours, that woman ran away a long time ago when she was still a girl. She settled down in another village. She's gone. She's changed a little from the unpleasant little girl that she was, but no, dear Zhu," she says, "our bond is not to be found in her childhood. Its beginning is found 9 lifetimes of yours ago, when you were a rich trader, employed me to watch over your accounts." She tells him, "You were a good man even then, but I was not. I repaid your trust with the theft of thousands of taels of silver. Consequently, after I died," she said, I was sentenced to be reborn as a fox. Aaron nailed it. Since then, I have labored over several hundred years through meditation and the training of my heart and mind to cultivate back into a being capable of honor and compassion. I have made progress, she says. But to advance further, I needed to find you and make amends. Thus, when your horrible, ugly servant escaped, I took her place. Over the years, the past 10 years, in fact, I have done everything I could to pay you back. This past month marked the full repayment of my debt. Soon I will quit this flesh, and after my spirit leaves this body you have held against you night after night, I will return to my true form, a fox. However, although dead and rotting, this body will have one final task. Therefore, you must order your servant Yi to bury me. Not because Yi will do a great job of it, but because Yi will disobey you, and instead of burying me, will hang me upside down and skin me.
Ugh.
This is because four of his lifetimes ago, while I inhabited my fox form, I came across his dead body on the side of the road during the times of famine, and I made a meal of his corpse. Skinning me will balance things between him and I and settle my last debt so that I don't have to reincarnate again. So now that her confession is complete, he's like, what? She makes a tiny little cry. She's like, and she starts to collapse in front of him, like melting like Obi-Wan when he's hit by Darth Vader's lightsaber. Just collapses on the ground. And he looks down and amongst her robes, there's like a dead fox in his living room now. He's like, what am I going to do with this dead fox? This is my lover. And he's watching as he picks up this dead fox and he says, a tiny little woman starts crawling out of the dead fox's ear, like wriggling out like a worm, like going like this, wriggling out. And she's only a few inches long and her face is totally different, but he knows it's Ja. It's her. And she kind of like says, yay, yay, and ascends. This little figurine ascends into the air and disappears, like gives him a wave goodbye. And he's just, he's devastated. It's like,
yeah,
he's,
exactly.
He's
That's
perfect.
Actually creating
he's,
karma.
His twin flame, his soul partner has passed away, all in a bid to just like balance the karma with him. And so he goes to search for Yi to fulfill her last request. And get him to bury her so he can eventually skin her. But at the last minute, he's like, I can't do it. I can't have her fox body desecrated like that. I'm going to bury her myself. So he digs a hole in the yard and he buries the fox body.
He's just stuffed up the whole process.
But the next morning, he goes to pay his respects at the new gravesite and he finds the grave vandalized and the fox's carcass is gone. And he eventually discovers that it was a grave robber, Yi, who dug up the fox, skinned the corpse, and sold the fur on the market. So the point of the story is that the Yi's actions, the guy that skinned the fox, illustrate we are not absolved of past debts just because we become better people. These accounts must be settled. The wounds we inflicted upon others in our past remain, even if we change. And I thought that's so great. Great karmic lesson.
Very much
to
so.
End the segment on. It's like you can be the most incredible person in the world, but you still got to pay the debts that you owe, even if it's from previous lifetimes when you were a horrible person who ate a dead guy on the side of the road.
Well, these are just different egos. Like the one thing that people need to understand is that you are simply an awareness. Like you are like the thoughts you have right now, they're not your thoughts. Like what goes through your head is not yours. Like you are the awareness observing what's going on. And what happens to that awareness, though, is that it does accumulate karma. And so when you move from one body to the next, like changing clothes, you still carry that karma with you. So you have to. You can't just be ultra virtuous unless you pay back the debt.
How many dead guys on the side of the road do you think you ate in past lives?
None.
There's got to be.
No, I'm like one level away from enlightenment, so I'm good.
How much dead guy on the side of the road eating karma did you accumulate to be stuck doing the show for 19 years?
That's a good point. And then you and I stuck working together for that long.
I probably ate you a couple of times.
I ate you a couple of
times.
Then
you tried to settle the debt. Like you were a bear or something and you ate me in the woods. And then after a while, we were up in the heavens and we were like, dude, we can't just keep eating each other on the side of the road for all eternity. Like, we've got to figure this out. We've got to balance this karma out.
I know how I can get us out of this so we don't have to reincarnate. 20 years of podcasting.
Yeah, just, and I was like, no, dude, anything but that. Like, anything. Let's just keep eating each other. I was like, dude, let's just keep eating each other. Another 1,000 years of eating each other
would be better than 20 years. And now, you obviously fell for it.
You convinced me. I was like, let's flip this dice. Let's flip this coin. And just we ended up here. And that's the end of the show. Thanks for listening. If you want to access Plus, there's more coming up on the show for our Plus members. MysteriousUniverse.org/Plus. Help support your favorite show. Aaron, remind us what's coming up.
Spirit Roads and Night Guard Watch Duty for the Old Ways. I'm going to be going into these very strange encounters that people have had with graveyards of all places and some of the strange creatures that have emerged and stalked people from those locations.
Nice. Any carcass-eating stories?
Well, it's funny you should mention that because it's not necessarily carcass. Well, we don't know it's carcass-eating, but one thing that seems to pop up a lot is the spectral animals that people encounter, and I'll go into them. But people encounter, obviously the classic is the black dog, right, with the red burning eyes. But there's also strange shape-shifting creatures, wolfman-style creatures. But in some of these cases, what's really weird is that a bunch of people will experience like the same animal. Like they'll be walking their dog or they'll be going for an evening stroll or, you know, they'll pull over their car for whatever reason. Mm. They'll encounter one of these weird shape-shifting creatures and people will start going, no, you know, you're obviously making it up. But then there'll be graves will be dug up by some strange, and they're like, oh, it's animals digging. Like, but why are animals digging them up at the same time that people are encountering dogmen? Like, it's very, very bizarre. So we'll go into that in a moment.
Interesting stuff. MysteriousUniverse.org/plus. Sign up today. You get access to the extensions we do every single Friday. And of course, if you sign up for our Plus membership, you get an exclusive show every single Tuesday as well. If you sign up for the Emmy Max tier, you get access to our entire back catalogue, going back years and years and years and years. It's all over there on the website. Check it out. Helps support your favourite show. That's a wrap for this free edition of MU. Thanks for listening. If you're on Plus, stick around for the great stuff after the break. For everyone else, we'll catch you next week.